Again, just a reminder, we're recording the Q&As, but if you're not comfortable with having your question recorded, just say that and we can pause it, or yeah, we can basically pause it, so no problem. Anyone, please. Yeah, Andrea.
I have a question followed on from what Lawrence said at the last session, which was his was more of a doubt of the process of the imaginal for him as a person, but this is more of a fear, really, about returning to the context of home.
Yeah.
Particularly as it relates to, you know, here seeing your own divinity with so much permission and so much love and support. And it's been hard, even then, at times. So to return to a place that just feels in many ways that it doesn't support this kind of work, how can we take courage and continue?
Yeah. Can everyone hear that? Yeah? Hopefully we'll speak to that in the closing day, you know, but the culture does not support that. In fact, the culture probably thinks it's unhealthy and mad, dangerous, etc. If there is something in you that feels moved, called to that vision of things, or at least to moving in and out of that vision of things, then just like any practice, it needs support. I was just reflecting, you know, a minute ago, it's pretty amazing that we can come together for less than a week and all this stuff can happen, you know, and people having experiences and understandings and connecting things and you know, struggling with all that, which kind of tells me it's more available. A lot of this stuff is more available than we tend to think or assume. I think the secret being off-retreat, and we'll repeat this, is you need to be nourished. Okay, now it doesn't mean 24 hours of every day of the week. It means getting enough input of different views, yeah? Because everywhere we look in society, this isn't the view that you're going to get. We'll be talking about this in the talks tonight and tomorrow night. You know, what is the cultural view of self? What does the culture do with self? We're inundated by that, surrounded by that. Ways of thinking about the self, pressures on the self. The self is this, it's not that. It's supposed to feel this way, and at the same time it's contradictory, it's supposed to be doing something else. So what's important, I think, is getting enough of another message, and that could be through reading, it could be through listening, could be through friends who are also interested in that, and there's sharing and there's mutual back and forth and support and listening and other people's ideas. So that's one thing. I think we underestimate, and this goes for all kinds of practice and kind of, you know, opening to the mystical in its whole range. It's like it needs a lot of support. But that support doesn't need to be continuous. It just needs little openings, little injections, little short readings or whatever it is. Yeah. And that goes for practice as well. If we go back to the beginning of the retreat, where I said, I'm not emphasizing continuity, I'm not emphasizing focusing the mind, etc. What I'm emphasizing, or what I'm hoping to get instead, is this sense of agility. And that means in one's daily life, in the busyness, in the demands and stresses, there are little moments, little pockets in the day where it doesn't have to even be a half an hour, 45-minute hour sitting, little pockets in the day where there can be this shift of the way of looking, and that gets more and more agile. And absolutely do not underestimate those. I think it would be better if I could do a long retreat, it would be better. Not necessarily. Absolutely not necessarily. There can be these little moments and just become these shifts of tapping into something imaginal, cosmopoiesis, whatever, divinity in this, that self. They just become much more available, much more frequently available, much more accessible. And don't believe the assumptions of the mind that think they're not. Practice. Practice. And I, as I said, I emphasize the flexibility of the way of looking, the agility of the movement of the way of looking over continuity for this kind of work. And actually also for insight work, as I would conceive it, in terms of understanding emptiness, etc. Does that, so it's two things, and I think they're really important, yeah. I'll say one more thing. You know, should I say this or not? Maybe I'll say that other thing in the, you know, in the closing. Is that okay? Yeah. You can use the B word instead if you want.
That was my question.
Yeah.
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 I mean, all of this fits is a real kind of deepening of that.
Mm-hmm.
My reason for practice,
yeah.
Which is a Bodhisattva, but it just feels.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that for the benefit
of
all beings.
Okay. Yeah, could everyone hear that?
No.
Okay, so Dajoji is saying, I was making the distinction. I'm not sure how much is actually edited out of the tape. So there was actually a whole talk about this distinction between self-intention and divine intention and et cetera, but that's definitely not here, and I can't remember how much. Anyway, it will be on Dharma Seed. But first of all, about that, you know, there are maybe... It's not either or. It's not so black and white. There's a spectrum there, and we move along that spectrum. So at times, or even periods of our life, it's totally appropriate to view the practice as for myself, for my growth, for my healing, and all that, yeah? And other times, you know, where it's just flipped, and practice is about practicing for God, not for the realization of God, but for God, for you could say for Bodhisattva. I'd like to nuance a little bit, an alternative to what you said as well. So you could say practicing for the Buddha, or it's the Buddha practicing, or the Buddha is creating the Buddha through my practice. God is making God through my practice. But not too quick. The first thing is that there's a range, and we may. People fall in different places, you know, so no one's forcing you to be on this place or this place on a range, ever, yeah? So I just want to, it's like expand the possibility of the idea that there is a spectrum here. Sometimes just hearing the idea, then a person can decide where they want to be on that range. So, yeah? And we move over years. We move. You know, it might be that a certain amount of healing is necessary, and a certain amount of this isn't what you're asking. I know. I'm just setting the scene. A certain amount of healing and integration and coalescing, if you like, or consolidation of self is necessary before one can then kind of offer that up and let that go and see the whole thing from the perspective of the divine. So that's the first thing. That's really for everyone. But in terms of, you know, I was like really trying to keep this word divinity open, so that if that's what works for you, great. It's interesting that we've been using the word God and divine more on this retreat than say Buddha or Buddha nature. But you can think of them interchangeably. even the Buddha nature has a range of meanings, you know, in the different traditions, people arguing about what it means, you know that. The thing I wanted to... So it's up to you, yeah? If that's what is alive for you, then go for it, you know? I still think there's a difference, there's two distinctions that may be possible just to point out, and again, not say you have to do anything at all, we're just talking about possibilities. One is this thing about levels and dimensions. So it could be that one is serving all beings or seeing one's practice in the service of all beings, but all beings is seen in what we're calling a kind of flat way. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't have this other dimensionality, the sense of what a being is or what a human being is and what exactly I'm serving when I serve a human being. It's a bit, you know, what I would call modernist humanist. It's just a bit flat. Now, if that works for someone, if that's what they dedicate their life to and that's meaningful to them and that's alive to a certain extent in their soul and that's what they want, great. Absolutely wonderful. So no, I really don't want to get, so you have to see it this way, you have to see it that way. But just in the language you used, the language didn't communicate this sense of the beings. Now, it might be that that's there for you anyway. So who is being served? What is a human being? And who is the one serving? What is involved in the serving? What is the one serving? What is the bodhisattva made up of? What comprises a bodhisattva? Yeah. And that relates to the second thing, which is... it's a bit like, okay, if we put it in more Buddhist terms, it's like I might be meditating on a tantric deity or something or whatever, and my purpose can be to grow my qualities so that I serve all beings. And kind of just extending that a little bit, my purpose can be serving that deity. Like, my practice is doing that deity's work. It's part of that. And even like, who is it really who's doing my practice? It's the deity. Who is it really who's speaking right now? It's the deity. So there's, you know, these are, in some respects, these are really subtle distinctions. We're quibbling with words or something. But actually, there's a range here of different, dimensions dimensions of how we're conceiving practice. So it could be the bodhisattva, the one whose aspiration is to serve all beings. It could also be the cosmic Buddha. It's not a bodhisattva, he's already arrived. He's already complete. It's already the perfect Dharmakaya manifesting in your images with the perfect Sambhogakaya, in the perfect Nirmanakaya, the perfect manifestation. And that doesn't mean one is then stupid and thinks that everything one does is, you know, exactly appropriate and perfect and no one can criticize me. There's a kind of multi-dimensionality of the view in the moment. Here, there, listening, right now, looking, listening is the Samantabhadra, is the cosmic Buddha. And it's also the fumbling, foibling human being. It's, do you see? So, does this, yeah, is there more or? No? So, really want to stress, but personally, what I find a little troubling is getting kind of told how to view things, or only allowed a certain limited view. And unfortunately, that's too common in our world, and it's even common in the Buddhist world nowadays. This or that, you know, different sects, secular Buddhism and all this stuff. It's almost like, this is the only view. What matters to me is that there's a plurality of views, because people will... Their souls want different things, need different things, need different views. And there are many people who are actually comfortable moving between views. So even this aspect of what you're asking about, you can move between different views at different times and just have that spectrum of views. It's like, you know, it's like, if we take the art metaphor, it's like, if I say to you, you can only have one piece of art that you get to listen to, look at, or whatever it is. That's hard. You know, we want a choice. We want a range. We want a range of moods. We want a range of all kinds of stuff. Yeah. Same with views. How does this sit?
It's good.
Yeah.
There's one sort of related thing around. It just feels like it's such a razor's edge between the kind of conceiving way of looking and belief.
Yeah. 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 That also, the whole thing about a razor was also in a talk that's not on this retreat. But it's really important, you know. this has come up several times. This thing about the real, not real, and the kind of, it's the middle way in the Dharma. That's the middle way, and. Two things. One is, my experience is that what seems like this really fine tightrope walking act between reifying and dismissing, believing or denigrating, what looks like a razor's edge, this really razor-thin tightrope act, that the more we... either the more we understand emptiness or the more we liberate that kind of artistic view of things that I was talking about or certain philosophical perspectives, that razor's edge, which appears so thin, I can fall off one side or the other, it actually becomes a huge playing field. If I can find my entry into that middle way, it actually opens up all the possibilities and doesn't feel tight at all. But all I can say is... apparently there was one teacher, whatever anyone asked him, would just say, more practice is required, which is a little difficult. But in a way, I'm partly saying that, especially about the emptiness piece. The artistic piece is something that, you know, different people find their way into, even before they understand the emptiness thing. It's a mode of being. It's an artistic, as I said, attitude or sensibility. But also, I would say, you know... you're going to wobble. One is going to wobble. And I've said this to several people, the fact that you're asking, the fact that you're cautious, it shows the awareness, it shows the carefulness, it shows the care, it shows the alertness on the lookout. It's a healthy doubt, yeah? You can wobble and you can find your balance again. And you can wobble either way, you know, in a dismissal or an over-reification. I would say expect it to happen. It because you've maybe felt like you've done it so much before and then it was so painful or whatever, or it led to bad consequences, it's like this doubt, the sincerity in your question, the sort of integrity and openness and vulnerability in your question, it will prevent it being so extreme. But you will wobble, you'll fall off that way and then you'll fall off this way, and this micro thing, it's okay. You know, you'll see it's not... There are micro wobbles, usually, rather than this whole big lifetime of plunged into the abyss of reification or whatever. Do you see? So I hear the caution and the vulnerability and the pain there, but I could, of course, be wrong, but my sense is it's not dangerous in the same way because of all that care. And it's almost like, don't be afraid... you know, as I said, it becomes not a tightrope act, actually, as you get into it. But let's use that analogy. When the tightrope walker is learning to tightrope walk, they get up on something this high, and they're falling off thousands of times. And it's part of the deal. Or what's that thing about horse riding? It's like you just have to learn to fall off, or...
Is that...
Yeah. I've never actually seen a horse, but yeah, or bike riding, or whatever it is. You know, it's like it. Part of the problem is the fear of the thing, and actually, you realize these micro falling one way and the other. Now, some people have a tendency to fall off more to the left, to the reification, and some people have a tendency to fall off more to the kind of nihilist dismissal of everything. But generally, we just keep falling off. And as we go deeper, you could say, or get more experience with all this, A, we get less afraid of falling off. It becomes less of a sort of big life catastrophe, sort of, I'm there for 10 years or whatever. And I can't remember what B was. We recognize it, and it's less of a big deal, and we can just find our way again. That wasn't B, but anyway, that's... So it's really important question, but my sense is let yourself play. And, you know, children playing, they fall over, it's fine, they get up, you know, it's... Yeah? Okay. Andy, yeah.
So this is kind of related to the last two, which is about kind of moving back into kind of insight meditation, Theravada circles, and still wanting to engage seriously with that and to take like things like renunciation seriously.
Yeah.
But then also recognizing that a lot of those renunciatory things can end up being kind of soul shrinking rather than soul making. I'm wondering like how to balance the two in a sensitive and productive way.
Yeah. So Andy's asking, what's the you know, there's still this attraction to sort of more classical Theravadan style Buddhism with its renunciation aspects and encouragement as well. There's the attraction to that and the attraction to these other things that we're talking about and how to balance the two. Yeah. When you say renunciation, can you say what would be an example of that?
Or what do you mean? Something like, when you talk about the attitude to sexuality, for example, mm-hmm. which in Theravada Buddhism is not very well developed or thoughtful. And towards like, you know, to art or sense pleasure, to kind of political engagement, you know, and it's like trying to kind of love and care for all those things,
yeah.
But at the same time, recognizing that kind of they're going to be shoved aside or sort of been told don't bother,
yeah.
And sort of then the fear will come up, which is like, oh, but then you know, perhaps like, I am indulging too much,
yeah,
it's not terrible thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, perhaps you are. just kidding. I would go, it's like one way of approaching the question is through fantasy or through the recognition of fantasy. So it's a bit like the other question you asked in the other group. You see, the renunciation is not just a good idea, it's actually alive for you as something that's attractive as a fantasy, a way of living. Do you understand? As is the artistic sensibility and the intellectual and the creative and all that. Yeah. So you have, as we've been saying several times in groups and stuff, you are a multitude. There are lots of archetypal callings pulling on your soul or inhabiting your soul. That's multiple blessings, and it ain't easy, you know, because sometimes they just go like this and they pull in different directions. Sometimes one goes quiet for a while and one is more dominant. Sometimes they're just at the same time and it's not clear, you know. But one can have a life, I feel very much, one can have a life where actually all of this is included. But what partly allows that is the sensing some of these modes, let's say the mode of renunciation, as image, as archetype, and letting that image be alive, or the artist, or whatever it is. So I think I shared in some talks, you know, one image that's alive for me is the jazz musician. You know, I was a jazz musician for many years, so it's like, and that's it, but that's an image that can live on in me and come up in all kinds of subtle ways, in subtle moments, without me needing to give up everything and go and start practicing my instrument again and going out and being a professional jazz musician. You understand? The flavor, the image fantasy flavor of jazz music can come up with nothing to do with music. It can be there. Also, the monk is very live. And, you know, for a period in my life, I was talking with someone else about this. I gave up music. I was on my way to the monastery to be a monk. Guy House kind of sidetracked me, and I'm still here. And hey, No, I'm kidding. I changed my mind. My mind was changed. But the archetype of the monk is still alive in me. And so, you know, these it's a bit like Andrea's question, similar in the sense that you don't need a big concrete chunk of time or a choice between A and B, between black and white, left and right, or whatever. The monk archetype can be alive for little moments in your day in such a nourishing way, so that that hermit, that renunciate, the love of that, the fantasy of that is beautifully alive, maybe in little actions, maybe in, you know, days of more silence or whatever, maybe in just the smallest little thing, like the smallest moment, and that's enough to nourish the soul. It's letting, getting out of the concretization of either or big life choices and actually into the fantasy of both, whether it's art, or literature in your case, or the monastic, the renunciate. It's like actually both of them can live when I allow the imaginal to come alive. If I don't, then everything becomes a choice between, becomes so concretized, yeah? So that does, yeah, that's one way of approaching the question, is actually allowing it to have more imaginal depth and breadth and richness, allowing these pulls, you know, and these attractions. Where there's meaningfulness for us, where there's attraction, eros, in this case the eros of attraction to the Theravadin sort of archetype, and where there's meaningfulness, where there's eros, where there's soul-making, where there's beauty, that means there is an image operating there, or several images that are alive, and you can, it's helpful to recognize that and let them become alive, yeah, and then we have much more freedom, much more depth, much more nuance with the whole thing. How does that sound? Yeah, well, a lot of this... Go on.
But it's, I suppose it's just the kind of... The question that always comes up, especially when I come to retreat for a while, you know, is I kind of move back into the kind of monk archetype, and then it's like... there's a sort of a worry that, like, well, you should, you know, if you really want to kind of follow that to its end, then, you know, the others should be pushed aside, but they're kind of wasting your time in that respect. And so it's just a question of, things that aren't in that kind of archetype would pull away from the kind of
end. Yeah. Well, one of the two things. One of the reasons, like I said, I left the States, I left the music, actually didn't sell, gave away everything, but and wanted to be a monk. And part of the reason for deciding not to was realizing you didn't need to. I didn't need to. If you say, I have to be a monk to realize the unfabricated, I have to be a monk to realize the depths of emptiness, etc., I don't think that's true. Practice is, you know, the fruits of practice are available to us if we practice, you know, with our hearts, with dedication, with intelligence, with practicing in ways that liberate. So we can also practice in ways that don't liberate. I spend lots of time with every earnest, heartful dedication. I'm just going around in circles or just hitting a brick wall. So it's really, you know, I don't think you need to be a monk. I don't think one needs to be a monk. I don't think, actually, personally speaking, I don't think you need to be a monk. But it's because I know him, I can say that. But so that, you know, that's it's not, you know, don't necessarily buy the hype. And then the second thing, what you touched on, is about permission. I know it was kind of a joke, but in a way, just saying something serious about that, Catherine and I were talking, it's like a lot about this kind of retreat, and maybe you've felt it already, is actually giving permission to ways of seeing, to sensibilities, to things that are in us, giving legitimizing and giving permission to. And that's partly why it's good for people to come to Q&As and groups, because you actually see, oh, that part of me that I was a bit quiet about is actually shared, recognized, celebrated, it exists in others, you know, all that. So I'm just pulling that word permission out and kind of saying something bigger about it, yeah. Atam, yeah.
My question.
Buddhism is about religious ecstasy.
Uh-huh.
I'm just going to name the fact that I'm very frightened right now. So
frightened to ask her?
Nervous, so I can just put it down.
Okay.
So, as I shared with you this morning, Rob, a lot of this retreat is very familiar, but it's gone really, really deep. So I'm kind of fortunate and blessed to be quite primed to lots of the things that we've been doing. They're very alive in my practice, like having a love being and four elements practice and cosmic kind of love surrounding energy bodies, mantra. These are really in my life. However, the effect of the way that you and Catherine have offered these things to us has caused me to have numerous experiences. I want to be brave and go there, I want to say cosmic orgasms, and I don't mean physiological, and like, not consciously at the time, but like looking back and saying, oh, I was enlightened for a few minutes there, and things like that. What I would like to understand is that I don't feel that I'm going to be grabby or graspy of these experiences, and I have no idea, because I can't read the future, if I will experience them again at home. However, if I go home and find that I can, they might be dangerous or cause, trigger my potential to have psychosis or mania or like feelings of, what do you call that, like vast bigness, like self-aggrandizement. Please, will you help me understand how I can smallify them or something? That's not a very good word.
Okay. So two things, maybe I would say. One is, it's a bit related to, you have to see what we're doing in the context of the bigger path, like, you understand? So when Catherine was talking about the black that surrounds the flame, you know, that black is cooling. One of the original meanings of Nibbana is cooling. It's cool, it means cool, it's one of the meanings, it means cooling. So, in a way, you know, people are very. This what I say is, I think teaching group retreats is a crazy business. I mean, it's like there's so much diversity, and people are in what they need, and this personality, and that person, or that tendency, and it's all wonderful. But some people need to gather the resources of cooling, of calming, of equanimity, as well as the resources of kind of a steadiness of love and steadiness of, you know. Yeah, so it might be that one of the things for you to think about, not instead of all this, but alongside it, is also gathering, developing the access to coolness, to space, to equanimity, and that kind of thing, because that will balance things. That's one thing. So that, you know, it's really about having a vision of the breadth of practice. As I said this morning, this is asking a lot. There's a lot involved to really have available the picture that we're presenting, and different people, it's almost like, will need to develop this a bit more, or that a bit more, or this first, and then that. Or so you have to kind of know also what your tendencies are. Now you're speaking them. So one of the things is, yeah, more access to coolness, steadiness, equanimity, a kind of more spaciousness of perspective, rather than, wow, here's that amazing thing, and I'm just lost in it. Yeah. So there's a kind of, what comes is a kind of balance, a poise. And the flame can still be there, but it's not just this way or then blown out completely and then burning everything. Yeah. So that's one thing, just to think about the kind of practices and the kind of reflections and attitudes that give that help you access more of that cooling spaciousness that gives you equanimity and steadiness. Yeah. Second thing is relates to what we've been talking about together, about putting the divine healing energy that you're feeling, making sure it contacts the dukkha. And that sometimes means even when you're feeling great, deliberately bringing up the dukkha, the memory of the dukkha, and putting it right in the middle of that lovely bliss feeling, and just letting that wash over, letting the two come into contact. And the more you do that, the more the sort of extremes of our existence are kind of, they meet, they start integrating more. Yeah, so we've talked about this. That would be a second thing. And the third thing might be, and it goes back to this question of real and not real, and I don't know what else to say about that, other than I feel that, it's not the extremity or the intensity of bliss or vision that's dangerous. It's not that. It's the, that's real now. And either identifying oneself, this is now, this is who I am, or that's exactly how things is, this is now the reality. It's the realism that's the problem. And what I was talking with someone else, often what happens is we don't realize that the realism is happening. We're unaware. What have I made real at this moment? And it could be a certain vision of the world, or it could be myself when I'm in this state. I am that. And I'm so entranced or captivated, enchanted in not such a good sense, with that I don't realize there's too much realism in it. How one moves, to let go of realism without falling into a dismissal and it's all rubbish, waste of a week at Gayak, waste of a could have gone to, Torremolinos or whatever. it's like, it's again this poles thing. So there's something about finding this middle way. Right now, I just can't think of anything else to say about that. But that's an important, at least having it as an awareness of something, of where what the mind can tend to do. It's not just you; it's the human mind. It's consciousness, and just being aware of that, and then looking for it sometimes. So there's a way that, just when we're talking about art, there's a way that these practices and these openings of perceptions can have immense power to heal, to move us, to give beauty and everything. And just like art, they don't have to be real to do that. They don't have to be believed. So the power, that's why I made the artistic analogy, the power is in that. But you might be on the lookout, gently for this kind of grasping realism thing. So that would be a third possibility. Yeah? Okay. And I don't want to neglect this side. John, yeah.
Thanks so much for your teaching this morning about mitzvot. You say commandments.
Mitzvot, yeah.
And blessings, which really spoke to me.
Good.
It kind of tied in with a worry I had about, I think it was your last Dharma talk, what you said at the end, which maybe I misunderstood.
Uh-huh.
I'll say what it was. It was about pragmatism.
Uh-huh.
So you said something about pragmatism, and then you talked about the sacred, the profane, or maybe the other way around.
Uh-huh.
And the thing it feels to me is that with that the mitzvot of the washing the hands,
yeah,
and the blessing sanctifies it.
Yeah.
It's not just a useful, if I understand what you mean by practicing correctly,
uh-huh,
it's not just that the action, that the commandment, the good deed is a convenient way or a useful way. You can't. I feel I can't be instrumental about it.
A useful way for what?
Well, for anything. It is in itself holy.
Yeah.
It's real.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you could explain what you meant by pragmatism.
I'm trying to remember. I think if I remember, it was particularly in the context of circumscribing the sacred as separate from the profane. So that, for example, going on pilgrimage, is that place there is a holy place I will go on pilgrimage to from my ordinary place where I live or whatever. Or this retreat space is a sacred space, or this temple is a sacred space, as opposed to profane space, yeah? And so sometimes what you get is teachings that say everything is sacred. And in a way, that's where we want to go, towards seeing everything is sacred. But sometimes we want to jump there straight away, and we just say everything is sacred. But quickly that just kind of dissolves into a mush where actually nothing is sacred. So the pragmatism is really in recognizing the skill of circumscribing certain things as sacred. So, you know, the biblical temple, or the temple in biblical times, was sacred. It was definitely, it's not that the rest of life wasn't, but it's like, it's a sacred place. And the Torah scroll is sacred, you know. So there's something, you know, and in Kabbalistic teachings and Hasidism and things, the encouragement is to see everything as sacred, to redeem it in that sense. But the sort of more intermediate step is saying their sacredness, their sacredness. You enter into a different relationship. Or when you do ritual, you're actually creating something, creating a taste of the sacred, and that serves a purpose, a sort of, I won't even say intermediate purpose, but intermediate in the sense of on the way to seeing it everywhere. So that's all I meant at that point by pragmatism.
Yeah, I think I understand now that I actually misunderstood the word circumscribe. I thought you were talking, we could kind of just jump over the sacred. Whereas to me, maybe what I should have understood is it's sanctification of the sacred.
Exactly. That makes it sacred. Yeah, precisely. Yeah. Okay. Good. Sampo, yeah.
Seeing all things as divine, especially the kilesas, and the images of the divine we have, like the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and so on, are all kind of these the light gods.
The light gods, yeah. Yeah,
or the nice guys.
Yeah.
Even though they might have a bit of fierceness in their compassion or whatever, they're not the dark gods you've mentioned quite many times already. So could you, and it feels like, for me to see the ordinary and the nice things as sacred everywhere around me, it requires that I can see the dark side of things as sacred as well. Otherwise, somehow it doesn't go as deep with the light stuff.
Yeah.
So could you say something about the dark gods? Unless there's a talk coming.
Unless what?
Unless there's a talk coming.
I honestly can't remember what's in there, but you know. maybe. yeah, actually, now you say, I remember mentioning that. I do, honestly. It's in one of the two coming up. So. Again, people are different with this. So souls are different. Souls have different resonances. Souls have different callings, you know. And also souls have different ways of developing, we could say. So some people, as you're saying, I can't really kind of get as much as I could from the light gods unless I integrate the dark gods. Other people, you know, They need a lot of time with the light gods. It heals something, it reassures something, it settles something, it opens something, and then maybe at some point there's a capacity to integrate the dark gods. So people are different. What you're saying, someone else might be like, and they may not even be ready to hear about dark gods. It's like it's not just it just won't fit, or it disturbs them because it because of things that have happened in the past, or wounds, or stuff that it's too similar to that, or because of cultural conditioning that they just can't see through, all kinds of reasons. So, first of all, there's a difference. I think when I started teaching about the imaginary, I was very much emphasizing the dark gods, and partly I just find a lot of what I teach to be a response to the context around me, which, as you say, it's all this. So it's like, well, hold on, what about this, guys? You know, what about this that we're missing? What do you need about it now? Like, what are you kind of asking? And like, because you just said, could you say a bit more? Which I could say lots, but can you, like, what is it that you're needing?
Just that there's a lot of nice experiences with the light gods in this retreat, personally as well. But there's moments when the kilesas are more active.
Yeah.
There's more, or it comes in the analytical mind, it comes on about. And it's and then the sensibility kind of grows, or kind of sense to that something's missing.
Yeah.
I can't say much more about.
Yeah.
Like some of all the loveliness around here could be more, could be fuller.
Yeah.
If the connection with the dark side was more.
Yeah. So you're asking how to make that connection? Okay. Good.
Basically, because the images we have and the images that I naturally or I feel like are coming on to me don't include those.
Yeah.
And I think it's more of a question of conditioning and less of a meaning.
Less of a what?
More of a question of conditioning, not kind of receiving those as readily.
Receiving which is really the dark gods. Yeah, sure, it is. And it's a question of culture and assumptions and all kinds of stuff. Culturally, for thousands of years, we don't really have a place for the dark gods in the Western culture. You know, I mean, what happened historically was a lot of gods were sort of amalgamated into the Christ image, and other gods like Aphrodite was more, if you could say, sexuality as sacred. It got seen as a demon, you know. So culturally, in the wider culture, also Gaia house culture, we tend not to, or Gaia house as an institution tends not to really go there and talk about that and include that or sanctify that or recognize the sacredness of the dark gods. And again, that's part of the reason for some of these teachings. On this retreat, in contrast to the sort of last few years where I've been saying a lot about dark gods, I feel like it's more, I've been a little bit more towards the light sort of thing. How in terms of how to do it, it might be just in imaginal practice, like just be open to the diversity of images. You know, a dark god involves a dark image, and dark in a very loose sense here. You know, things like sexuality, things like rage, or certain kinds of suffering, or loneliness, or some kind of what might be regarded as pathological element. And it's like those images, if you like, are darker. Does it make sense? So you can just be open in your imaginal practice, and they will come. Otherwise, you wouldn't be asking the question. They're part of what you need. They will come as images. And it's always a sense of like, okay, the mind is, not in your case, but maybe the mind is saying, oh, I don't know about this one. It's not, you know, it's this or that, or it's not holy or whatever, or it's just my kilesas. In a way, part of the potency of bringing imaginal work alive and letting it do its soul-making function is just. I'm saying this to everyone now, just granting a little bit of trust to the image. My mind doesn't, not sure if I can trust this, just give it a little bit of trust, just give it a little bit of, just the beginnings of belief that there might be something holy here, there might be a treasure for me, there might be something that's asking something of me. And that's enough to inject life and potency into the image, and then it can start doing its work. And some of these can become, you know, really beautiful soul-making divinities, you know, available to the soul, absolutely. And the other way around is actually, so one is just more open in imaginal practice, and they will come. Or, you know, as you shared before, it's like what moves you, perhaps a painting that you see or a work of art and a character from that that's more dark, if you like. A second way is through, as you said, through an emotion or through a bodily energy that comes up. Where a longer retreat, we'd probably talk much more about desire and eros and that kind of thing. But it's, you know, what is it again to feel that and to allow it in a way, and even just entertain the possibility as an idea, there's something holy here. It's not just an impurity, just a kilesa, just greed, just dirty sensual desire. You know, just having that attitude liberates it a little bit. So one way is through things that are arising, and the other way is through images and just being open to more images, a range of images. Is that okay? Are you sure?
You said you could talk.
Okay.
So let's keep it.
Okie doke. Okay. And let's have just a minute of silence. Yeah.